Ladies and gentlemen, on the behalf of the Carnegie Middle East Center, I would like to thank you all for attending this conference on Libya. The fall of Gaddafi regime in Libya presents an unprecedented opportunity to build, not to rebuild, but to build, construct the country and completely shape . So we have our speaker who is missing, Tarek. Welcome, Tarek. It's an unprecedented opportunity to build and construct the country and shape its institutions and policies. In fact, since 1969, the country has suffered from excessive centralization of power, absence of state institutions, mismanagement of massive oil revenues, inconsistent economic policies, hostile business environment, and I can continue for a long time. But besides opportunities, Libya faces also tremendous challenges, be it political, economic, or social, both in the short and medium term. And like in Tunisia or in Egypt, political structures and state institutions need to emerge from scratch. To discuss these challenges and what do they mean, both for Libyan and for regional and international communities and their ramifications on their neighborhood, we have with us today four speakers. Diederik van de Wol, Sousen Ben Romdan, Emmanuel Santi, and Tarek Youssef. Welcome all to Carnegie, and I would like to thank you very much for accepting to contribute to this event. We very much appreciate at Carnegie your participation. So the working language of the event will be in English. There is a simultaneous translation for those who want to have Arabic translation. I would also like to inform that the event will be streaming live on the website www.lebanonsfile.com to allow interested people outside Beirut and outside Lebanon to follow the event. So our first speaker is Diederik van de Wol, who has been following Libya and Libya's development during the past two decades. His research focuses on comparative economic development, specifically in North Africa and Arab Gulf states. Dr. van de Wol was until recently political advisor to the UN on the post-conflict planning for Libya. So he's very knowledgeable about the opportunities and risks facing Libya in this particular moment. Diederik, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Rahsan, and thank you to the Carnegie Endowment for inviting me here to come to Beirut. As Rahsan said, Libya is really facing a large number of challenges. And the title of my presentation was the economic and political reconstruction of Libya. And the first point perhaps to be made is that we're not really talking simply about reconstruction. We're in many ways talking about the construction for the first time in Libya of a large number of institutions that it has never really had before. And what I would like to talk about today is really to talk about this kind of construction, reconstruction of Libya in a much larger sense than purely the economic, and I have several reasons for that. First of all, because we have with us three eminent young economists who are going to be able to talk much more about the economic aspect of this. In part also because I've written quite extensively by now about the economic reconstruction of Libya, and that has been either published or is in the works to be published. But then, most important, Because I think if you think of among the enormous challenges that Libya will face, certainly the economic challenge will be a large one, as Libya gets what is often called the gold rush effect, as lots of partners are now rushing into Libya to provide it with all kinds of needed and unneeded financial help. And so Libya's problem over the last 40 years in many ways, and something that will continue into the future from an economic point of view, is one that most oil exporters frankly face. That is, too much money, in a sense, that is not used very efficiently all the time, a capital surplus country. And so from that point of view, I think even though that challenge will be enormous, and I think my colleagues will talk about some of those challenges, I see that the larger challenges are really those that are needed to sustain economic reform, economic construction, or reconstruction in Libya. And those two challenges I kind of would term, on the one hand, a process of state building that needs to take place in Libya, and then beyond that, and by state building I mean essentially kind of building the, you know, to for those of you who know a little bit about the technical language, kind of develop the rules of the game by which the Libyan state will conduct itself into the future. And then the larger challenge beyond that is really what I would call a nation building, where you need to give some relevance to those institutions of the state and to those that are, you know, to Libyans more generally. In other words, you need to kind of create legitimacy and consensus for the state. Now, for all of you who know a little bit about Libya and who know a little bit about the history of Libya, you know that Libya, for all practical purposes, has seen very, very little, either in terms of state building or in terms of nation building. It really goes back all the way to independence in 1951, but it certainly was measurably added to by the Gaddafi regime, which, as you know, and as Lahsen mentioned in his introduction, was really very deliberately intent on destroying the modern institutions of the state, thinking all the way back, you know, from extractive institutions, taxation institutions, and in a sense what you had in Libya was a very, very lopsided state that, as I described it in one of my previous books, really became what I called a distributive state, that is, whose principal economic purpose was to distribute the money that was made to maintain a kind of a social contract that in Libya in particular meant that citizens really had no voice. So what Libya will now be asked to do in the future is really, in a sense, quite contrary to what its country's leaders have tried to do for the last 42 years. And so on the one hand, you may say, well, you know, that's maybe good news. You know, you have a tabula rasa, you have a clean slate, you can start from the beginning. And that, of course, does have some opportunity. But the bad news is, particularly in oil exporters, that there are so many chances for what I call spoilers to emerge in this process. And indeed, in a few minutes, I'll tell you where I see these spoilers already emerging in Libya, that they can really offset this, you know, what is a very graduated and a very difficult integrated complex system of creating institutions for the state. So again, in light of the history of Libya, this is very difficult. Again, think back to the kind of destruction of the state that Gaddafi envisioned since 1969. Remember, this is a country that, strictly speaking, did not even have a national army as a unifying force. You know, quite different, of course, to what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, where the army could emerge as a buffer between state and nation, so to speak. And it was very much, the Libyan system was a patronage system that relied very, very extensively on close access to those in charge of power, were in charge of the country, and of course that means Gaddafi and a very few people around him. And we saw this patronage system emerge. It resulted in a kind of social contract, as I've often described it. And particularly during the last decade, when Saif al-Islam, the so-called reformer of Libya, really tried for the first time to introduce some changes. What we saw, the last decade in Libya was really very important because it showed you how strong the resistance was in the country to any kind of reform that Saif al-Islam and some of the people around him were trying to advocate, in part, I should say, for their own economic purposes. And so what we've seen until now, since the conflict started in February, and we're now, you know, at the end of September, let's say a 6 month period, is that the civil war, of course, has effectively hidden a lot of these deficiencies. Everybody was very interested in ousting the regime itself. There was very little criticism until very recently, and I'll come back to this in a minute, of those that were leading the effort to overthrow Gaddafi. And so kind of in the euphoria of the victories against the Gaddafi regime, a lot of these fault lines that had traditionally emerged, and I think that Tariq will talk about in greater detail in his presentation also, really were kind of submerged amidst all the chaos of the civil war that you know, that was taking place. And so in this chaos, you saw the beginning of what was really a kind of an embryonic effort for the first time at creating that first complex kind of process that I described to, that I named state building. And that is the Transitional National Council, the TNC, as I'll refer to it, and really emerged amidst this rubble of the civil war. I think you know most of the important personalities, Mahmoud Jibril, Mustafa Abdel Jalil, and then the man I'll come back to in a minute, Abdel Fattah Yunus, all these kind of national figures that emerged. And when the TNC emerged, the major questions that it had in front of it really was, first of all, to what extent did the TNC really represent Libya? If you want to talk about the creation of national institutions that the TNC kept talking about, you know, did they truly represent Libya as a whole? You may remember that in February, right after the unrest started, that everybody pledged allegiance to the TNC, but again, that started breaking down after a few months. The second question was, did the TNC truly have the ability to build capacity, as the United Nations likes to call it, to create these kind of new state and beyond that, the new nation that Libya would need? And then the third question really was, and again an unresolved question today, to what extent could the TNC or its successor regime eventually to come really accommodate some of those that had thrown their lot in for so long with the Gaddafi government? And of course, one of the problems is that in a system, in a dictatorship that has persisted for 42 years, that very, very few people, unless you left the country physically, very few people could not, in a sense, cooperate with that regime. Well, as the TNC started thinking, and I followed this very closely, about creating some of these institutions that could be used in a post-Gaddafi situation, they created for that purpose a large number of groups and kind of proto-institutions, if you want to. The most important one being the Libya Stabilization Team, and that emerged that worked primarily in Dubai, and that in July came out with the first kind of stabilization initiative for Libya. At the same time, the TNC went through all the kind of elements of state building that we in the West take for granted. They started thinking about a constitution. There was an enormous amount of debate in Benghazi at the time about the constitution of Libya, how it, you know, what the kind of election system should be like, you know, allied to it. There were lots of scenarios that the TNC went through about what do we do, you know, for the first 2 days once the Gaddafi government falls, what do we do in the first 100 days, and so on. All the kind of scenarios that are normal in these kinds of, you know, post-civil war situation. And then, of course, there were plans for a parliament and for elections, and there was an enormous amount of discussion within the TNC on what would happen to the members that were actually members already of the TNC, whether they could run for office or not. All of this was eventually hammered out, and the TNC, in a sense, was on a roll, so to speak. It really did quite well until the death of Abdel Fattah Yunus. Now, you may remember that Abdel Fattah Yunus had been a military commander for Gaddafi, who had then thrown his lot in very, very early on with the opposition. But despite all that, of course, remained very much a disputed figure in Libya, and particularly in the eastern parts of Libya. And when Abdel Fattah Yunus was shot, the TNC at that point held a conference and argued, first of all, that this was the work of a Gaddafi faction that had assassinated him. What it turned out, of course, very quickly, that it was actually a militia on the rebel side in Benghazi that had been responsible. And I mentioned the Fatih Yunus assassination or killing in part because it became very, very clear right after the assassination, these kinds of fault lines that had late submerged during the civil war. First of all, there were major fault lines. It was suddenly, or not so suddenly, the United Nations had done a lot of work on this and discovered that the military units in Benghazi itself were fractured. There were more than 40 militias in the time at Benghazi. By the time you got to Misrata, and remember, Misrata is important because it suffered tremendously during the civil war. But in Misrata, for example, there were over 120 militias. And if you remember how the difficulties with which the DNC then had to convince some of these militias to kind of be folded under and never really completely successfully, it was one of the first indications of kind of the disruptures that were to come down the road. Remember when Jalil gave the press conference in the aftermath of Fatah Yunus' death, that he was surrounded by tribal leaders. There was not a single member of the TNC in the room, and at the funeral the next day for Fatah Yunus, again the same thing. No one from the TNC, but tribal representation. And again, that was the emergence of another fault line that again had been submerged during the civil war, the emergence of tribal affiliations. And there were a number of other ones. Islamists emerged politically very strongly right after the assassination of Fatah Yunus. Those, the young people that had fought in the actual battles versus those that had been in Benghazi, Libyans inside the country versus Libyans outside the country. And so it looked immediately, almost in the aftermath of the assassination, and certainly within a couple of weeks, that the TNC showed all the kind of fractures that would eventually perhaps have resulted in a complete breakup of the TNC. No one could really have predicted it. In part, and I should also say, you may remember that the cabinet was asked to resign as part of this, in the wake of this assassination, and was never really reconstituted. And the TNC, in a sense, was helped by the fact, of course, that it was at that particular point in time, the Western rebellion in the western part of the country, again, the emergence perhaps of another fault line that then carried the rebellion into Tripoli, and very, very quickly, against almost all expectations, was able to overthrow the Gaddafi regime, even though, of course, Gaddafi himself has not yet been caught. So the big question then is, in light of what has happened in Libya during the last 6 months, and in light, I should say, not just of what has happened in the last 6 months, but also in light of the kind of the history of modern Libya since 1951, it seems to me, the perennial question that always comes up after a civil war is exactly the one that TNC and eventually its successors are now starting to face, and that is, yes, they've won the war, can they now really win the peace? And that, in its sense, is really a very different challenge that they are facing now. Now, my point is simply, by means of conclusion, that in light of the history of Libya, I think we should be pretty cautious about what we can expect in this kind of reconstruction of the country. The first fault line remains these militias. This is a state where, or this is a country, I should say, where the state at this particular point in time still does not have the first prerequisite of any modern state, that is the monopoly of violence. We've seen several incidents in Misrata, the appointment of a military commander in Tripoli that was then challenged by some of the other groups within Libya, the general situation of weapons in Libya. I'm sure you've all read these reports of incredible amounts of weapons floating around, including these SA-7s, these shoulder-fired missiles that everybody is now starting to worry about. But then the second point, of course, is that, again, if you think back in terms of history, Libya really doesn't have any institutional history, doesn't have any history of dealing with issues like democracy, modern elections, and so on. The fact, thirdly, that we've started to see a large number of cleavages emerging within Libya with, you know, let's call a spade, no real unified leadership yet in Tripoli, and increasingly difficulties in kind of thinking about the unified leadership, no charismatic leader in a sense that can take up the struggle for a unified Libya. And then the biggest challenge of all that Libya will face again is, of course, when the oil money starts flowing again. If you think back to this old Burkean saying that, you know, the revenues of the state is what the state really is, we've seen a very deleterious impact of revenues in Libya over the last 42 years, and so whether or not Libya can kind of escape that curse is, of course, the big question here. And then finally, I think one of the big issues that is emerging and that will be largely determinative to what extent Libya moves forward is really outside help that is coming in, that kind of gold rush that I referred to initially. There's two issues here. First of all, that Libya will have, or soon will have, a capital surplus again, and again that money could be used for patronage purposes, much like the Gaddafi government used it. But the second point on which I would like to end is really that in many ways Libya's current revolution, if you want to, because now of course they call it the revolution also, will likely be a very nationalistic one. And certainly when I was both in Benghazi and Tripoli and you talk to some of the TNC people, particularly when you talk about to some of the younger technocrats that are starting to man these ministries, you get this idea that this indeed will be a very nationalistic kind of revolution, new revolution, if you want to. And so a lot of the, from an economic point of view, a lot of the traditional models that have been suggested by multilateral and bilateral lenders so far to Libya, including the World Bank, are likely to be challenged by the Libyans, particularly if they focus very extensively on Western-style governance practices. The second point is that the model of an economy based primarily on liberal principles and guided by a democratic political system, the way the advice is now being given to Libyans, may be a very long way off if indeed it will ever emerge in the country. We shouldn't forget that there is very little pressure, in a sense, that international institutions can put on Libya. Libya needs an enormous amount of expertise, but it is a surplus capital country, and so that has very much its own complications. There will be, in Libya, I think, an enormous amount of skepticism. We've already started to see that emerging around Ali Tarhouni and some of the people that work for him about these kinds of liberal economic programs. In many ways, of course, because that 10-year period that I just talked about, the Saif al-Islam so-called referendum, which was really an attempt at the imposition of a liberal economic reform program, led really to an even greater amount of what can only be called crony capitalism, in which those that advocated the reforms, that is mainly Saif and some of the people around him, were those that profited most handsomely through corruption from the imposition or the attempted imposition of those reforms. And then the final point I would like to make is that if you think about this reconstruction of Libya, and particularly the economic reconstruction of Libya, that remember that very few Libyans have known anything but state intervention very consistently over the last 50, 60 years or so, and that the resistance to state intervention traditionally has been relatively low in Libya. The other point to remember is that willy-nilly highly inefficient state enterprises, and we shouldn't forget that it's estimated that 70 to 80% of Libyans still are employed directly by the state, that these inefficient state enterprises will at least for a while need to be kept on the books until new jobs can be created. And I think my colleagues will talk about this in a few minutes. So my overall conclusion is that the kind of state building that Libya has engaged upon, of which economic reconstruction and management is part, will slowly take place over a long period, perhaps much longer than we in the West would tend to assume it takes. But at least if we can see some positive things there, I think the larger process of nation building, where you instill some kind of loyalty toward those institutions, I think will be a lot more difficult in Libya. And the combination of the two here between state building and nation building, I would argue, will either take much longer than we had expected or that we expect in the West, or shows many opportunities, again, for people to defect and for these processes to be very, very suboptimal in Libya over the years ahead. So let me maybe stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Didrik, for this enlightening and very dense presentation. I think that you underlined the issues of state building and starting from a situation where there is no real modern institutions, but at the same time you mentioned the heavy and huge legacy of the Gaddafi regime that needs to be managed, and the financial resources, even though available in the Libyans' case, will not be sufficient to solve all the issues, and there are a lot of political and social challenges that need to be addressed. We are going to come back in the presentation by Tariq to the political economy of Libya again, but let me now give the floor to Manuel and Sausen, who will be presenting the regional impact. Libya is a country with a lot of problems inside, but also with ramifications on its immediate neighbors, especially Tunisia and Egypt, and Sausen and Manuel will give us a talk on the regional impact on Libya's conflict and now the new situation and opportunities as well for the neighborhood countries. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks also too for inviting the African Development Bank to join this event. We are often a bit relegated on a certain part of the world, and it's always a pleasure to actually come also visit the Mashrek and be here. Very pleased to be here today. Thanks also for giving the opportunity to actually even navigate and travel a little bit outside Libya and bring also the perspective that that we feel very much, very closely by being based in Tunisia. And following what is happening in Tunisia, which is the country that is probably the most affected one on the Libyan conflict. As we'll see, basically in the presentation, we're going to be focusing initially on the short-term impact that the Libyan crisis has had already on the Tunisian economy, but also looking at the reverse and trying to sort of look in a very esoteric way about how we look at Tunisia rebounding or not based on this exogenous shock. And we're going to try to attempt to have some policy recommendations that we actually, this is a very fresh exercise that we are currently undertaking with the government of Tunisia to advise them on what to do next. And the bank is actually looking at this very closely with a view of possibly even assisting the country to in this regard. As you know, the events that disrupted in Libya had significant effects both at global level. There's a little typo there, but because of oil, of course, oil production's coming to a halt and prices going to spiking very high. And the on neighboring countries, and a lot of the African countries have been affected through loss of FDIs, but the returns of migrants, loss of remittances. And I must say the African continent has been affected a big deal, especially the neighboring countries. We have seen high numbers of migrants going back to basically poor without any possibility, and adding into a really dire situation in many countries like Niger, Ghana, and Chad. Thank you. And of course Tunisia. But we have to actually take a close look at Tunisia as a country that actually faced this the conflict in the neighbor in a very unprecedented time and a very historical junction, in which basically Tunisia was already suffering from some of this negative side effects of having just gone through a revolution, damages that had occurred, not as much as in many other countries, luckily for them. But also this uncertainty by investors, which have been scared off, and loss of revenues in tourism because, of course, of uncertainty. So what have we done? We tried to sort of, as I said, in a very esoteric way, trying to look this work, actually, which actually materialized in a paper which is available outside, was really carried out at the time in which the Libyan conflict was not very clear where it was heading to. But we tried to analyze the conflict, I mean the impact of the conflict through a variety of transmission channels. As you can see from the chart, we've been looking at through trade, tourism services, remittances, and FDI as main. And as you see in the sort of little chart, how different elements have been contributing to actually having this big exogenous shock, which has hit employment very hard, and also the balance of payment, the availability of foreign currencies, and then, you know, subsequently GDP growth. And now we're going to go very quickly on the different impacts. Of course, the more details can be found in the paper, so I'm not getting you too much bored on that. But the impact on trade, of course, has been an immediate impact. And at the time, we were still not very, we didn't know exactly how much the border closure would have affected. So we have tried to draw some scenarios that you'll see in the paper. But it was interesting because from pure trade balance point of view, Tunisia seemed to have improved because, of course, the imports have been dramatically decreased.
Trade balance with Libya.
So the trade balance with Libya, thank you, Sasan, was really improved. Although, of course, if you look at the trade composition of the trade, the oil, which was making a biggest chunk of it, of course, was easily replaced through Algeria. And so it was kind of like a fictitious improvement of trade balance, and sort of you will see it later in the calculation we estimated, we're trying to sort of isolate that impact. Now, the impact on migrations and remittances, according to official data, there were 92 Tunisians working in Tripoli, I mean, in Libya, according to the data provided by the embassy. But of course, we all know that the data on migrations are generally to be revised upwards in the reality. At the time of writing, half of those migrants were returning back, and the estimated loss of remittances ranges from 50 million dinars, which is about 25 million euros, to a higher case scenario that we actually estimated of 125 million dinars, so equivalent to 75 million euros. So just to get a sense of the impact of a new unemployed in a situation of a radio crisis, plus of course loss of remittances on which families, villages were actually depending on. We go to the impact on FDI and banking operations. The countries were really at a time in which they were really strengthening the relationship, and Libya was the fourth largest Arab investors in Tunisia. Over 30 Libyan companies were actually operating. There were plans to actually increase the capacity of investment to up to 2 billion. Conversely, Tunisian investments also exceeded 2 billion dinars, about 1.5 billion US. So the impact was quite sizable, although very difficult to actually anticipate on the longer term. The impact on FDI and banking operations. Interesting enough, of course, despite the freezing of the assets and actually stoppage of virtually all Tunisian investments in Libya, the impact of the crisis on the net balance was actually positive because of a lot of cash actually flowing from from Libya to Tunisia and creating a big liquidity. But of course, that was very it was a very short temporary effect. Then here we have a really simply, you know, there's a little forecast on the macroeconomic impact. We will not go into greater details. As I said, the paper is there. But we estimated that the total impact was between plus and minus. You will see also there is a plus, which is a consumption. Indeed, the flow of Libyans in Tunisia actually created also a consumption spree, which we try to calculate as a positive impact. So despite a positive impact and the positive impacts we just mentioned on the investment, the net effect that we calculated is at 0.4 percentage points of GDP, which led our estimates to actually be revised downwards to 0.7, which is much closer to reality now and way far away from what earlier estimates on the Tunisian GDP growth, namely by the IMF and the World Bank, were pointing to. So what are now, that is reversed, seems the situation is reversing with a lot of uncertainties. What are the opportunities out there? I mean, of course, Tunisia is naturally placed to benefit from the proximity, geographic proximity, language, similarities, and historical relationship, including, and I'd like to strengthen that, because that has been a critical point, the amazing support the Tunisian government and people, Tunisian people, have given to the Libyan refugees by welcoming without really complaining much, like other countries on the northern shore of the Mediterranean, by receiving 800,000 people crossing the border, out of which many of them Libyans, which actually found a residence in Tunisia, even. And without necessarily finding conflicts. And that's the amazing experience of actually living in Tunisia, where you can see several cars with Libyan plates and which are actually making the traffic horrible, but no one is really, because no one is really complaining. I mean, that's, you know, you're simply doubling the traffic and it's okay. So what are the opportunities? The government made an estimate. Actually, we're working very closely with the government on this, and they made an estimate that Libya could absorb up to 300,000 new jobs, which is actually quite important for a small country like Tunisia, which actually has quite sort of a high number of unemployment, but small in the population of only 10,000 people. So the capacity to absorb, Libya could potentially absorb both skilled and unskilled labor. Tunisia has also the resources to actually leverage on its capacity for technical cooperation program, services in utilities, architects, engineers, health services, was already one of the services in which the Tunisians were excelling. About 70% of Libyans were reported to actually come in a way or another to Tunisia to seeking for health care and education. And there's already experience of technical cooperation with GCC countries, with African countries. So there is a lot of room for even more institutionalized cooperation in the health and education sector, but also bringing skills which Tunisia has a lot of, as in abundance, like ICT. And of course, we talked about institutional cooperation. Of course, investments is opportunities on both sides. We will not go into details. And of course, trade. And here is the good news. Since the opening of the border, those data are just fresh, coming out of thanks to South, since made a miracle in actually fetching them out from the Ministry of Trade just before coming here. We already see a big spike of export from Tunisia. Some of them are re-export of products which actually come transiting through Tunisia for purely logistical reasons, so we still have to assess the details of this, but I think that trend can be sustained, especially from some products which, as you know, do not travel very easily, like cement and agricultural products. But what is the big ticket item? That's the vision we are trying to sort of help formulate. The big ticket item is really the possibility of having a deeper economic integration between the two countries, given all the complementarities. And it's fascinating that we really, some people may think that we are really talking nonsense here, and talking way ahead of time. But if you look at the European Union and its old reconstruction, the idea of putting the country together, which came after a conflict, it came after a sort of a shared experience. I think there is no better time than now to think about those two countries, which actually benefit from great complementarities, which have worked together, were collaborated, and they had a similar, yet with all the distinctions, similar historical junctions politically, to actually come together. We can see and distinguish also in line of what's also the government's jargon on this, three different phases. The first humanitarian aid phase, in which the government is making very clear that they don't want to be opportunistic about entering Libya like some, but actually to care, to worry about humanitarian assistance. So actually, thanks for reminding, the task force has been set up in the government, that sits right below the Prime Minister, to actually look at those issues. And their main focus is, and we heard it loud and clear, the big focus is humanitarian aid at this point. There is going to be a second phase, which is going to be about economic transition, and then we see a third phase about deeper economic integration. The two countries already benefit from virtually a free trade agreement, and there is scope for further integration through creating really a common economic space and labor mobility. That would be a key. So really the strategy forward that the government is really looking into is really to start by building trust and giving all the assistance, and then eventually reaching mutual benefits without front-loading the opportunistic, the focus on opportunities. So I'm almost done. And what are the policy recommendations? And we have already started discussing some of those with the authorities. There seems to be a consensus that Tunisia needs a comprehensive roadmap of how to take advantage of the proximity, how to take advantage of this, how to be prepared. Of course, migration will play a big role and could be an important response to an employment situation in Tunisia, but it would need to be prepared through planning of measures, systems to accompany labor, such as job fairs, but also other ways of filling the gaps of skills gaps by organizing the offer. Tailor support to Tunisian companies, UTICA, the main patronat, the private sector organization is actually planning to open a branch in Tripoli. And there are some special access, there's some funds for exports, such as FAMEX, and there's some insurance that they already exist, and they're already thinking about creating a special access fund given the conditions. And then, of course, strengthening the regulatory framework to ease access to investors, like looking into right of establishment and so on. International cooperation is also going to be key, and Tunisia is already becoming and can be a point of entry to Libya. There's already an experience of triangular cooperation, which is actually just being initiated now with France, which is using Tunisia as an entry point to a market that France is not so closely associated for the time being, but will be. And the key that we're actually putting forward is that all this work needs to be done in collaborations with the private sector. Public and private sector need to work together. Some caveats, just to cool off some of the excitement that we may have generated in this room, is that Libya will not be the panacea to all Tunisian problems. Tunisia will still have a lot of work to do in-house to solve some of its governance problems, some of its competitiveness problems, and address directly the unemployment, which is very high and is not it cannot be only solved by Libya. Tunisia also needs to improve its logistic performance to really become the gateway to Libya. Up to now, Tunisia actually ranks only 61st out of 150 in the logistics performance index, and there are still some problems. Infrastructure is good, but trade logistics, trade facilitation is still pretty much deficient. Today, carrying a container through the port of Rades may take up to, I think it was 15 days or 13 days, which is basically a sub-Saharan African average. Conversely, the experience of, and sorry if I'm taking a lot of time, but this is an interesting anecdote, the excellent experience of Rashidir and the way Tunisians, which had just before the revolution, had just
border,
created...
Rashidir is the Libyan border.
And then it was just really the state of the art for logistics. They had just had, created... And that state-of-the-art border, from a logistics point of view, helped actually Tunisia also manage the flow of the unprecedented flow of people. So the importance of looking at trade logistics is really a key to tackle different issues. And then of course Tunisia needs to be very realistic and with vis-à-vis the competitions. Tunisia cannot compete with Western countries, especially coming with those big oil companies, but can work in collaboration to provide, for instance, the human resources to feed this new oil, new or old restarting of the oil activities. What are the next steps? Just for information about this exercise, and then we finish here. We're planning to produce a policy note to feed the government working group, and actually this is an opportunity also to exchange view and hear other points of view to feed this discussion. And then this idea that is being forming about having a Libya Day in Tunisia, which can bring together all the stakeholders, and it would be interesting to see your faces again in Tunisia and possibly benefit from you, so that the Tunisian government can also benefit from your insight. And of course, they all, to finalize, really want to have the idea of to build a sort of a roadmap of what Tunisia can do. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Emmanuel. I should have said that Sausan and Emmanuel are both in the African Development Bank, based in Tunisia, and their work focuses on regional integration, and they are following both Libya and Tunisia. And one key message from your presentation is that these Arab Spring, and particularly in Libya and Tunisia, Egypt, is also providing room for rethinking regional integration. For Arab Maghreb Union, which exists from 89, when we look at the intra-trade among Maghreb countries, it's very, very low. It does not exceed 3% of their total trade. So this means that we are starting from scratch, almost. And there is a lot of opportunities, be it in terms of trade and integration, but also mobility. Didrik said the issue of human resources in Libya, and with the educated unemployed in Morocco, in Tunisia, and also the potentialities in Algeria, there is room. You have these political and institutional obstacles much more than real obstacles to trade. Once these issues will be solved, I think that there is a large room and very exciting thinking about the future of this regional integration. Exactly. So, thank you again for your presentation. Last but not least, our final speaker here is Tariq Youssef, very difficult to follow, a leading economist, currently CEO of the Celatec, after serving as the founding dean of the Dubai Government School, of the Dubai School of Government for 5 years. Tariq is also a senior fellow at the Brookings and chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda on the Arab World. He has extensively published in international journals and continued to conduct research on youth inclusion, political economy, of policy reforms, and above of all of that, he is Libyan. So we are very proud to have him here to give us his thought about the situation in Libya and the future of Libya. Thank you very much for being with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Hassan. Thank you to Paul, to Carnegie for hosting this event, for inviting me, and for giving me an opportunity to speak about Libya. It often happens to me when I speak about Libya that you realize on an issue in your own country at a particular difficult moment when there's so much at stake, emotions, and analysis, sense of history, hope for the future, all come together and make the presentation of a structured, standard, academic, policy-oriented talk rather difficult. And I would say, like most Libyans, and I hope there are some in the room here, this year has been an incredibly difficult year for us at the personal level, coming to terms. It's been a great one. It's been a great one, Rahim. It's been a great one. I say this because while we, I think, have fears about the future, uncertainty about what is taking place, and concerns, many of them were summarized nicely by my dear friend Derek, we also have a sense of hope and renewal in a way that many of us have never had. And I think that is in itself an important foundation on which we can discuss Libya and begin to think through a lot of the issues. I also wanted to thank Carnegie in particular, because just a few days in Beirut, in the middle of a discussion about Arab human development issues, it struck me that the Libya story itself, whether under Gaddafi or at the moment, and Libya's own history and its own experience, how it fits within the larger fabric of what we know the Arab world to be, Arab history, Arab development, is largely an untold story. It is one that has been incredibly distorted by the imagery of Gaddafi and those around him, and those who may have written and peddled projects and ideas associated with him. So for Carnegie to host this event was especially in light of the heated discussion one had a few days ago, where I think I at least developed a very strong sense of anxiety at a moment when I felt that perhaps a significant segment of the Arab world may not be aware of what was taking place and what is taking place at the moment, and why in fact Libya, and this will be my first point here today, fits very much within the larger phenomena of the Arab Spring. Libya, what took place in Libya, and what will happen in Libya is not an externally driven project. Our neighbors to the west need to come to terms with this and accept it, and need to recognize that this was a hard-fought, bloody, ugly, and painful war of liberation that couldn't have attained its goals without resorting to the only language possible at a moment in time when the opportunity arose, and after 42 years of immense political repression. Now, the role of the outside world, intervention, legitimate, not repeatable elsewhere or not, is something we can debate. But I think an important entry into thinking about Libya is that it does fit within the broader phenomena of the Arab Spring. And I don't think Libya would have taken place, or the new Libya, or the hope for a new Libya, if events in Egypt and Tunisia did not go in the way they did. Absolutely. And it is also the case that the victory in Libya, in my own humble opinion, is probably creating new expectations in places like Syria and Yemen as to what tools and options they may resort to should the paralysis of the moment last way too long. I think it is that framing of it that also allows one to maybe discuss very much more constructively and much more regionally the challenges of Libya moving forward in the future. If you accept the premise that what the Arab Spring about, the Arab Spring is about in many ways, is about political change, political transition, economic transition, then Libya, Egypt, and Tunisia will face similar problems, depending obviously on different initial conditions that each country comes to the table with. This is not a trivial issue, I would also add. It is not an issue where the academy knows much about in the Arab world or has thought a lot about. Most of our recent experiences with rapid political and economic transitions following revolutions have been informed by what we saw in Eastern Europe or in parts of Latin America. Whether that literature is relevant or not is an issue. How much of it is relevant or not is another issue, but that, it seems to me, is the core question at the moment facing Arab society, facing the new elites, and facing the outside world as we observe the continuation of the Arab Spring, namely these emerging economic and political transitions. Not only do we know much, I would argue that a lot of what shaped prior experiences, including in Libya, has to be updated with newer initial conditions. And I think Dirk van der Wel has probably done more to help us navigate the story of Libya than anyone else I'm aware of. Meaning the important, if you give me permission, Dirk, sort of the curse of history, in a way, that Libya faces as an initial condition. A country that was never really had a chance to be put together, governed. It's in own institutions that were on the way to being possibly developed in the late 60s, were somehow hijacked and disrupted. So the curse of history is going to play a big role in all of this. The curse of oil, as both a source of wealth and a source of rapid economic transformation, but one that also gives way to a host of illnesses and issues that Dirk has rightly pointed to. I would say the curse of Gaddafi is also is one of the new conditions. This is not 1951. The outside world didn't hand us independence on a silver platter and said, go do it. You're dealing with 42 years, a legacy that is fraught with issues many of us are only slowly coming to terms with right now. And I would just point to a few days ago, sort of the supposed discovery of the mass graves in the Abu Salim. Four Libyans in the 48 hours following that news announcement, the entire public consciousness was consumed by that announcement. This is only one of a number of issues connected to Gaddafi's own legacy and what a lack of legacy and what he leaves the country that is likely to shape the nature of the transition we see. This is an initial condition we Libyans have to accept right now. So not only do we not have institutions, we actually have institutions that were destroyed, disfigured, distorted, a system of government that became highly personalized around tribes and clans and where patronage became the norm. And a political system where I would argue related also an initial condition at the moment that matters for how we understand what we're hearing in Libya, absence and lack of trust vis-a-vis authority and vis-a-vis the instruments and the individuals who represent power. I think Libyans in 1951, following our first independence, were willing to cut a lot of slack to the emerging political classes at the time, although there was a lot of squibbling and wrangling and internal strife. I think the threshold now is much, much higher. Nothing gets done today in Libya, legacy of Gaddafi, without issues of mistrust, suspicion of our motives, questions over legitimacy and intent being raised on every single matter. And last but not least, I would say the curse of the conflict itself and what the conflict has given rise to. I think we will know soon what the death toll was, toll of injury, material loss, the accumulation of this over 8 months, together with 42 years of many instances of this, would also present one of those initial conditions that we would have to contend with. That will affect economic priorities, political legitimacy, political issues, the transition itself, the issue of trust, and creates newer, I would say, fault lines within the country. Derek was extremely, I'd say, candid in emphasizing the existence of a number of these historical fault lines within the country. Urban versus rural, Hadar versus Bedou, Tripoli versus Benghazi, and now you have the emergence of Amaziri nationalism, Tibu nationalism, Tuareg nationalism. But there are other newer dimensions to these fault lines that have emerged. Who served with Gaddafi and who didn't? That will also determine your profile and your legitimacy within the country at this particular moment. Islamists versus liberals, and I would say in the last couple of weeks we've seen an incredible surfacing of this brewing, growing confrontation between the two sides, whether it's legitimate, genuine, a subject mostly of social media activists and those who follow, we don't know, but the political space at the moment that is going to shape the two priorities that Dirk had pointed to initially, and I wholeheartedly and fully agree with him, state building and nation building, is going to be driven by these initial conditions and some of the updates to them. I would not lie to you when I say every day I wake up and I have a new surprise. I wake up and I have a new update for myself on my very own identity, my very own society, and my very own country. Just today, this morning, I was on a very emotional day. My dad, after 30 years in exile, landed in Benghazi. And the expectation was that he would be there with all of his friends from the intelligentsia, from the educated classes, those who helped set the foundations initially for state building, had plans for nation. I picked up the phone, called up some of my own cousins and asked, what happened here? What went wrong? I thought there were going to be speeches about the future of Libya. And he said, well, yes, there is that side of Libya that you know, but there is the other side. Libya was always, still is, and maybe now more so than ever, a tribal society. You cannot dismiss, ignore, or belittle the importance of these components of civil society and life in Libya, especially when political institutions were destroyed, and your sense of protection as an individual and family rested on your extended family and a notion. I think Dirk was absolutely right to remind us that one of the biggest tests in which I think the TNC failed a few months ago, and where you began to understand the limited legitimacy, the contested legitimacy of this body, is one that was associated with the assassination of Abd al-Fattah Yunus. After all, this was a man who was not only a larger-than-life figure, but somebody who came from an important part of the country with a strong tribal base. The inability to resolve that issue to date continues to cloud, or to hang as a major cloud over the legitimacy of the TNC and many of the individuals inside of it. So one important reality check from today on something that one took for granted reinforces my sense that the transition in Libya, like the transition in Egypt or in Tunisia, is a long-term project. I think the gaps that we're seeing between expectations and delivery on the ground is not only one that is affecting the public within these countries. And I would say that is one of the most pressing immediate challenges that everyone within Libya, Tunis, and Egypt faces. Just as the expectations for the fruits from these hard-fought battles are rising, your capacity to deliver is actually shrinking. Legitimacy, security, stability, hope, fear, and that creates the complications. I would say that gap also exists outside of Libya and outside of Egypt and outside of the countries of the Arab Spring. You almost have to feel like you have to defend yourself every day as someone who stood with the Arab Spring from day one in front of people who ask you. So we thought this was going to lead us to the promised land. We thought things were going to improve quickly. Can't we say that in fact things are much worse now than maybe a year or two ago in some other countries? I think the fact that these projects of state building, and in the case of Libya certainly nation building, are long-term projects, puts immense pressure on the emerging ruling elites. Here what I also agree with Durkin, I think he summed it up exactly right. The absence of charismatic, visionary, legitimate leadership in Libya that can at least provide that comfort zone, that bridge on which all parties can march, the platform that will create at least the beginnings of the making of a broader consensus, is probably one of the biggest challenges we face at the moment in the country. And I would say this is not only a problem that Libya appears to face today, it was also something it faced earlier in its independence, when those who led it weren't necessarily always willing, engaged, and wanted to do politics, because you need to do politics at a moment like this. This is a bigger challenge in Libya, clearly, than that in Tunis or in Egypt. It's a long-term problem, and I think we have to approach it as such. Elites owe it, outside and inside, observers, analysts, to begin to help shape the contours of some of these issues. Some of these priorities are not trivial. For example, what do we mean by nation building, practically on the ground? Is the obsession with elections really one that we ought to further entertain? Or maybe an exercise in which we try to create common spaces that will forge the foundation. I would actually be willing to go so far as to say, is the Arab Spring really about elections or about a democratic transition per se? Or is it about a political and economic process of transition that will bring about changes in things that people actually explicitly wanted? Rule of law, economic development, transparency, accountability. Those were the slogans I saw and heard people speak about. In Libya, this is also going to be complicated by questions of transitional justice. And that will be a priority that will emerge, not just in Tunis and Egypt, but I would say in Libya, much more treacherous and a difficult terrain to navigate for any political leadership that will emerge. Hence the importance of the cadre of individuals or groups or parties that will coalesce in the formation of the first national conference that will help put the country on, I would at least be the first step towards forging a common national consensus. If these democratic transitions are new and they're being informed by new initial conditions within these countries, including Libya, they're also taking place, let us all remember, in a difficult international arena. This is not 2000. This is not even certainly not 1989. The world has changed. The ideas for what constitutes good practice in public policy or in public administration is not the same ideas that I think we accepted or took for granted just a decade ago. This applies even more, in my view, to the economic space. The models that Dirk alluded to earlier are now much more contestable and open to debate than just a few years ago. Now, we might come down to the same models, we might come down to the same policy prescriptions, but all of this is now taking place in a contested global international environment of ideas, of resources, and in the middle of the worst recession since the Great Depression. The ability, the capacity, and the willingness of the outside world to engage, and by that I'm not only referring to the outside world in terms of Europe and the US, the region also at large, is also going to be one of the limiting factors. All of this leads me to a conclusion, and I apologize for taking a lot longer than I should have, that these are long-term projects that need to be thought of as such, sold as such. The primary immediate need in a lot of these countries, including in Libya, I would say especially, is to resolve restoration of public services, creating areas of trust, restoring faith in politicians, in those who speak for authority, being transparent, being open about the process that's going to lead ultimately to the goals around which a national consensus will be forged. More so in Libya, I would say, than in any other country. Let me just end by saying the following, and I've said this, I think, in other places. I cannot imagine a scenario, a realistic scenario for Libya in the future, with all of the uncertainty, with all the dangers, with all the political wrangling and infighting that will take place, and will get probably nastier in some areas and uglier. I cannot imagine a future Libya that will be worse than what we had at the end of 2010. That must be also one of the important foundations for approaching the future. That it's all about building a better future, but one hopefully that will have better foundations, that will have more sustainable outcomes, and one, and I go back to Dirk again, that will be able to resist the curses that Libya has faced in the 20th century as it begins to build a nation, a strong state, and be again, and I like the term of Libya becoming more nationalistic. Yeah, Libya needs to be more Libyan, more Arab. It needs to play the role that it should be playing on account of geography and history and initial conditions and its ties with Tunis and others. That would be the Libya that I think we all want to see. And I'll just stop here and say thank you for being with us today.